Welcome to Blind Like Me. It's Phil Parr here and visiting with Marcia and Steve Dresser from somewhere up in Massachusetts. Where are y'all at? Where are you?
We are in Reading, which is about 13 miles north of Boston.
Which is just a little suburb of Boston, right?
Right, yes. 25,000 people live here.
Boston comes right up to the edge of town, I guess.
Sorry?
Does Boston come right up to the edge of town? Or?
To Reading? No.
No.
No, there are a couple towns between us.
Oh, really? Well, Steve, how are you, sir?
I'm pretty well.
And you say they just started remodeling your kitchen today.
Yes, they did.
Like,
yes.
Tell us of that. What are they going to do?
Well, they are going to basically rebuild the entire room. They're taking it down to the studs and down to the ceilings coming down, the walls coming down. The floors are going to be leveled, and they're going to change. We have a closet in one part of the room. They're going to change the size and shape of that. All new cabinets are going in. Not all new appliances. We got a dishwasher and a refrigerator, and we're keeping our stove, mainly because it was a fairly new stove, and we like the way it works. So we didn't want to go out and wrestle with the joys of inaccessibility of modern stoves. You know, there's a lot of the flat-top stoves, which some people say they like, but I really don't think I like that kind of a burner. I like to be able to know by that little metal ring where the burner actually begins before I smell the burning flesh.
Now, is your gas or electric stove?
It's electric. I have used gas stoves before, and I don't dislike them, but I grew up with electric, and I think Marcia did, too.
I did, too, yeah.
And so we didn't feel any great need to switch over to a different kind of stove.
You know, you're going to find this ironic, but as soon as we get, I was telling Marcia we're going on a little New England trip, at which we're going to pick up the Cummings and take them up, and we're all going to go look at the leaves. Actually, Tim and Cheryl and I are not going to do too much leaf looking, but we're taking, my wife is sighted, and we're taking a girl with us that's sighted also, and so they can go, ooh-ah.
So they're going to look at the leaves, and you're going to look at each other.
We're going to talk about recorders and how fast them trucks will go. You know how it is, blind people.
Right.
Now, but as soon as we get back, we're fixing to turn our garage into a big kitchen.
Oh.
Well, no kidding.
So,
wow.
The house we have now, my wife built, and she wasn't, until I came along, she wasn't even going to put a kitchen in the house because she didn't cook then. Now she started watching the Food Network and has decided we need a big kitchen.
Oh, okay.
So we're fixing to go through the same darn thing. But I don't know about stoves. We have an electric stove that is a little four burner, and it's the old fashioned. I mean, the burners actually come out, you know, and you can.
That's what we have.
That's ours is.
Do they still make those, I guess?
I've heard that they do, and I've heard that they don't. And since ours was in pretty good shape, I didn't feel like finding out, so I didn't. But I think what is also an issue with some of the newer stoves is that they have a lot of touch panels.
Yeah.
And that can be as much of a problem if you can't figure out what actual temperature your burner is running at. It isn't going to matter whether you can find the burner or not.
Won't make any difference, will it?
Yeah.
Do you all cook a lot together or not?
I'd say that we're not extensive cooks. I mean, I think there are blind people who cook an awful lot. In fact, I know there are blind people
who
cook an awful lot more than we do. We keep it simple in the sense of, you know, frozen vegetables and, you know, things like success rice and stuff like that. Probably the place where I do more cooking than anything else is the grill, and that's another whole.
Yeah, that's great. And I like to do casseroles, you know, so that we put a whole bunch of stuff together. It tastes yummy.
But you do those mostly in the oven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you got to make them up first. So we're going to get new counters. Cause our counters are really this old ratty Formica.
Yeah.
We're not the kind of people who would sit in the kitchen all day and dice and slice and peel potatoes and, you know, grate stuff or you know, and cut up things. You know, if we, even in the casseroles, we'll use frozen vegetables because it's just so much easier to do it, you know. And
sure.
I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that both of us throughout our lives have worked. And, you know, you just don't really, when you get done with a day at the office, you just don't feel like coming, or in school, which is what Marcia does, you just don't feel like coming home and spending hours and hours in the kitchen to devour it all in 20 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't ask, but because I already know, both of you are totally blind.
Yes.
Yes.
Do either one of you have a guide dog?
No.
No.
And just both of you are cane travelers, I guess?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and
I've had a guide dog before. I've had three of them actually, but right now I do not.
Yeah,
I work in schools and I get rides to my schools, and I'm afraid I wouldn't work her enough, you know. I keep entertaining the idea. I know that if I ever get another job where I have to commute into Boston, I'll get a dog because I just think it's easier, expedient, more efficient, maybe to travel.
It would make sense if you went into Boston, but, you know, I don't travel much, so I don't have one, never have had one. But dogs, you have to be committed. I mean, you have to
That's
be.
Right.
It's a job to have one. Of course, they're wonderful for leading blind folks, but they're a commitment. I mean, you got to milk them in the morning.
Yeah.
You know.
Although in some ways, I think it's a misconception. I mean, the dog will. You still, you know, a lot of sighted people think that if you have a dog, you don't have to worry about knowing where you're going anymore. You just say, hey, Rover, take me to the library, and miraculously you're there.
No.
Right, no.
But really, in many ways, I think you almost have to have better mobility, even than you do with a cane, because the dog will guide you around obstacles, but you really have to have a good idea of where you're going. So you got to have a good internal compass of knowing where you are in the grand scheme of things. Otherwise, I think using a dog can become just as difficult and in some ways more difficult than using a cane, because now you've got not only your own understanding of what's going on, but your animal's attempting to make judgments of his own, and if they're not what you want to do, you're going to get awfully confused in a hurry.
Yeah, now that you've brought it up, I've always thought they'd be more trouble than they were worth.
Well, you know, that was always my feeling. I used to say when I was younger, you don't have to feed a cane. And in a lot of ways, what I don't like, I love the idea of being whisked through a parking lot around obstacles and through crowds and, you know, that sort of thing very quickly. What I don't like is dragging along the dog food and taking along the dish and dragging, you know, and having to maybe get up and clean up a mess at 3 a.m. And, you know, people who have dogs will say, well, you know, it's just part of what you do, but it's not part of what I want to do, so I just don't have a dog. And
I've got dogs.
The jobs that I've had in my life were not traveling jobs. They were desk jobs. So it seemed even sillier to bring a dog to work, have the dog sit under the desk all day, and then come back home on a bus where you weren't doing much work with the dog either. And so for me, it's never seemed like a very practical option.
I'm like you. I always went somewhere, and when I got there, I did my work there all day,
right.
And then I went home. So I only had two things to do, and unfortunately, I've had sighted people around. Let's get into lives. Marcia, you have no vision. Have you always been blind, and how did you get that way? And tell us about your younger days when you were...
I was always blind. I was born 10 weeks too early, so the old retinal fibroplasia, which is now called retinopathy of prematurity...
Yeah.
We both have that. I was very lucky. I had a very supportive family. I actually ended up going to a school for my first 6 years of elementary school where I was in a regular school in Malden, which is two towns away, closer to Boston. So I spent a lot of time with the Braille teacher and some time with the regular class. And as I got through the grades, I spent more and more time in the regular class and less time in the Braille class. And I think that was kind of the best of both worlds because I had some blind kids around me, but I also had sighted kids. around me too, so that I didn't have to. I wasn't at Perkins, say, and then changing to a high school. I already had the best of both. And so when I was in seventh grade, I just came back to Reading, and I saw teachers of visually impaired twice a week for an hour, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I had really good schooling.
Isn't Perkins in Boston?
Right outside in Watertown.
You just think that all kids around Boston would go to Perkins. I mean, it's such a famous...
Yeah. My mom, when I was young, when I was about five, someone came from the Commission for the Blind, and they told my mom that I was smart and could go to public school if they wanted that, and that's what they chose to do. So I'm glad. I think if I had gone to Perkins, you know, I know a lot of people, obviously, who have graduated from there and spent their whole school life there because I was from here. So every summer I went to camp with all those kids. And I think if I'd been there, I would have been, you know, the head cheerleader probably, or, you know, and I would have been, had all the solos in the chorus and stuff like that. I would have been a big fish in a small pond, but I think I got a better preparation for life the way I did it.
Probably so. We endlessly debate here and, I guess, other places, blind school versus public school, and I still don't, I've got opinions, but, you know, I know all the problems, I just don't have any answers.
Right.
You know, I don't know whether, I think you should be, you need to be around other blind people. You need to be around, you know, one of the reasons for doing the show is you need to be here from successful blind people, and by successful, I mean just dealing with it every day and making it, you know, life happens while you're making plans.
That's right. I actually, now I teach visually impaired kids. I'm a TVI, and one of my big pushes is to get my kids connected to other kids. And I have one student who is who's a print user who is sort of going over to Braille, but wasn't very enthusiastic. And now she's met some other blind kids, and her attitude is totally turned around, you know, because she's been validated that it's okay to have these skills. And so it's important to have blind role models, absolutely.
But then I've talked to blind people who went to all the way through a public school and just hated every minute of it. They were isolated socially and just didn't like it.
I think you can be. I think a lot of how you end up going through public school depends on the rest of your environment, which is to say, depends on how your family is.
Uh-huh.
Marcia and I were both very lucky to have grown up in families where the idea was that we would be as close to normal and participate in as many things as possible, which meant that if we went to school, we participated in school. We did what other kids did in school. And, you know, so we had permission to be successful, if you will. A lot of blind people, I think, don't get that kind of permission. And if they live at home, public school is a disaster for them because they're so protected they're not allowed to get out of their own way. And, you know, maybe for a kid like that, a school for the blind is the best thing because it puts them in an environment where nobody's going to say, oh, watch out, watch out, watch out, you're going to fall, because everybody's doing the same thing. I mean, you know, you can't play the overprotective card when you're amongst other blind people who are all in the same boat that you are.
And if you're blind, you are going to fall. There's no getting around it. You're going to run into chairs and walls and
bump into things. It's just a part of life. Now, I think for both Marcia and me, I can't really speak for her, but I will speak for myself. In Connecticut, the philosophy was very different. The philosophy was that you would go to a school for the blind. That was a given. And my folks were not really happy with that idea because they felt it was going to be isolating. I wasn't happy with it when I got there because I was used to a bigger world and... you know, I had kids in the neighborhood that I knew, and I didn't like the fact that I was really isolated from the people I was growing up with. You know, we were on different vacation schedules. They would get snow days. I wouldn't get them because the school for the blind was residential, and, of course, you know, that was on all the time. And even though I was a day student, I still had to go to school. So, I mean, there was a lot of stuff like that I didn't like. But there were some good things that I have to say I would never have gotten if I hadn't gone to a school for the blind. And one of them was taking shop. Kids who go to public school are just not allowed to do that. And, you know, in the school for the blind, our shop teacher was himself totally blind, had been since the age of 12, and he operated every machine in that shop. And the only accidents that ever happened in that shop were sighted people being careless. Because if he had had an accident with a blind kid, he would have been fired on the spot. They wouldn't have even
yes,
let him get to the end of the week, I don't
he
think.
He would have let you can stay till Friday. That would have been
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
But you say, did you say Canada? I thought it, you
no, said, Connecticut.
Connecticut.
Oh, I thought you said Canada.
No.
Connecticut.
No.
So you went to the Connecticut. Well, you know, I used to think all schools for the blind were bad. I've learned now that they're not. Mine was. But lots of folks had a great, you know, I've talked to folks who just, oh, man, the blind school was just wonderful for them.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I think it also depends on your perspective. I mean, I personally did not enjoy the school that I went to. I don't think it was one of the better schools for a lot of reasons, politics, you know, administrative kind of stuff. They were more interested in making big bucks for the superintendent than they were in accommodating the students. But I know people who went to that school and they absolutely loved it. And I think part of the reason that they did was because what they had to compare it with, in other words, the home lives they had, was just so abysmal that for them anything was better than their home life. And for me it was kind of the other way.
Yeah. Well, and then there are sighted kids who like school and sighted kids who don't.
True.
You know, it's not just blind people, but, you know, of course, you were a day student, so you didn't have, and Marcia, you didn't have it either because you went to public school. You didn't have that where they take you in September and you're 6 years old and all of a sudden you're in the care of an old woman that doesn't know you and it doesn't really like you particularly. You didn't have that. Had you had it, your take on blind schools may be different, but now there are kids who went to an isolated dormitory-type school that were isolated from their families that just had a ball. I mean, that just...
Even as a day student, though, Phil, I saw enough of it. And, in fact, in some ways, I was one of the nastiest rebels there was because I had the strength to fight, and I gave the house mothers fits. I mean, they actually were telling kids not to hang around with me, not that it worked, but... You know, I was just that kind of a... I don't think it did much for me. I mean, it gave me an abiding uncomfortableness with any kind of authority. But it also, I think because I saw it and because I knew things could be different, I probably also fought a lot harder than some kids. But, oh, yeah, I would never have wanted to be a night student in that school because...
Blind people see the world and see things differently than sighted people do, and it is very hard growing up for even parents of blind children to understand how you see things, how you look at things. Dale, this is my friend of mine, Dale, I was telling him this story about I bought this whisk that you stick, it's an electric whisk that you stick down in something and it whisks. Well, of course, I had to stick my hand in and see if I could stop it. And Dale said, you know, that blind people do that. Why we do that, I don't know, but we do, and we're different.
Well, I think part of it is just a simple that that's the only way you're going to find out what it does. A sighted person can watch it moving, and you can't.
I guess that's it. So, Marcia, you graduated from a public school, walked across the stage, got your diploma like a good little girl should. Right?
Yep.
What did
I got my diploma from high school, and I went to college. I went to a very small college, with Catholic college, with 1,600 students that was 20 miles south of Boston, that was very isolated. I think my parents were a little afraid to have me in right in the city. I wanted to pursue a career in broadcasting very badly, and my father said, no daughter of mine's doing that. So I went and I became a teacher, but which I like. I mean, but I had some bumps along the road to that. When I was at my nice, safe little Catholic college that I really hated, I wanted to transfer out of it, and my father kept saying, no, you're all right, just, you know, you're all right, okay. And I wasn't forceful back then. I didn't want to fight, so I didn't stand up for myself the way I should have, but I really have very bad associations with that college, and And, you know, they asked me for money and stuff. I'm like, no. I was in my senior year, first semester, and the professor, head of the department, took me aside and said, oh, you know that you're not going to be able to be certified as a teacher. We set up a work-study kind of program for you where you'll be able to teach kids at Perkins, but we're not equipped and we're not certified to certify you in teaching the blind, so, you know, you'll get a degree from here, but you won't be certified to teach. And I couldn't believe it. And when they picked me up off the floor, I went back to my room and cried for 2 hours. And the next day I got up and I started calling school systems because there was another blind girl woman beside myself. And I called around about 30 towns, and I finally got this nice person in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts, Mr. Peters. I'll never forget him. And he came and interviewed us, and he got, he let me teach in one school and my friend in the other. And I went back and told my professor, oh, by the way, I arranged student teaching for us. You can forget your Perkins gig. So it's one of my prouder moments.
You know, it's just amazing. I wonder why as many of us as we're interested in radio, and there are many, many of us, at least every other interview I do, I'd say, what did you want to do when you got out of high school? Well, I wanted to pursue a career in broadcasting. Well, my God, didn't we all? Why has nobody ever set up some training institute to train blind people to do radio and take the Commission for the Blind's money to do it?
I don't know. That's a great idea. I'd go. I'd certainly even help set it up.
I mean, too old.
Steve could help set it up. He's a fantastic engineer,
Who?
You know, and I've taken some voiceover classes, so we could, you know, we could even teach some of the classes, but, you know, I wish, what a great idea, Phil.
I'm too old to do it. I think it's one of those careers, though, that is very hard for anybody to see their way clear to getting a closure. You know, you got to remember that with the agencies, the big thing is closure. And in broadcasting, it's the kind of field that for every person you hear on the air, there are 1,000 that don't make it.
That's true.
And to send a blind person into a field like that, if the odds for a sighted person are 1,000 to 1, what are the odds for a blind person? And I think that's probably the thinking that discourages people from setting up that kind of a place.
It's true, but you can also, you don't have to be on the air. There are a lot of jobs, you know, the sales jobs and the traffic director and the, you know, promotions director, and there are different things you can do. You don't have to be.
Oh, you're absolutely
right. Now that we have computers, there are many, many, many things you could do. You could be a copywriter. You could do the log.
Exactly.
You could do traffic.
Now,
you've
raised, this is a good news, bad news kind of issue, though, because it's true that the computers can help us.
Yeah.
But now comes the ugly specter of third-party software, and a lot of the software that stations use to get things done is stuff that is just absolutely inaccessible to us.
You think so?
Oh, I know so.
JAWS or Windows won't work with it?
I can give you an example. I can probably give you, well, I can give you one definite example.
We'll do one. Okay. All right.
A lot of people in the broadcast industry for production use a program called Pro Tools.
Yeah.
Pro Tools is absolutely 182% graphical.
Yeah.
You fire that thing up with JAWS, and what you get is a blank screen. And that's the end.
Yeah.
And there's no something that's going to fix that.
Well, no, there's nothing that's going to fix that, but there are many multi-track programs that JAWS will work with.
That's correct. And if you can convince somebody, but one of the things that has also happened with computers, and I see this not only in broadcasting but in a lot of things, when you go into a place for an interview, they don't ask you, can you do sound production? They don't ask you that at all. What they ask you is, can you use Pro Tools? And,
but,
of course, we have to say no.
It's up to us, though, to steer the...
Yeah, if you can do it.
Yeah.
But the problem that often ends up happening, because a lot of the people who use the software themselves don't really know how to do things in an alternative world. They think you either do it with Pro Tools or you don't do it at all. And they're afraid of things like different file formats, incompatibilities of this and that, and rather than even explore it, it's kind of an irony, because the computer technology that should save us in some ways tends to hamstring us even more than it used to when the options were fewer and simpler. I wish, and I don't know how to get around this. I mean, I'm kind of glad I don't have to worry about it anymore, but if I were 30 or 40 years younger and trying to break into an industry, I've even seen medical transcriptionists. You know, you think to yourself, well, what can be easier for a blind person than medical transcription? And again, you're butted right up against this third-party software, inaccessible.
It was easy for a long time, and then all of a sudden now it stopped being easy. I actually did that in college, and I'm a really good typist, so I was using an electric typewriter. You know, I just didn't make any mistakes, or very few, you know, so I could do it. And then for a while in the DOS world, and even the beginning of Windows, people could still do medical transcription. But now all the software is inaccessible.
All of those jobs are being phased out.
Well,
I've seen the same thing happen with a friend of mine who's doing a switchboard operator in a hotel. And the biggest issue that they've had is that the software that the hotel uses is just unworkable with a screen reader, and there is no alternative.
Well, and also the way radio is now, there are so many stations that are unmanned a lot of the time.
Yep.
I mean, it's an entirely different field. I got in radio by buying my way in. I bought 2 hours a week, and they realized I was really better than anybody they had, so they hired me.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
And I did 40 years in small to medium market radio. I did everything there was to do.
That's awesome.
From engineer to, I was a chief engineer of a 50 kilowatt FM radio station at one time.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome.
Great. It was great. And the only reason it was a really hateful old man. The only reason I stayed is because I was learning. I couldn't have learned. How could I have gotten that experience, transmitter experience, by any other way? I couldn't.
That's right.
So, but I maintain if you're willing to work weekends, you can get into radio. If you'll work Sunday morning.
Yeah.
You can. But anyway, let's move along.
I'm a teacher now, and I'm well established. But I'm at the point where I'm going to retire fairly soon. And finally, I'm back in Boston.
Yeah.
I lived in Connecticut for 25 years, and I met Steve there, and that's how we got together. But I'm back home now in Boston, and I'm seriously considering pursuing it now.
Because the bug
will not go away.
They said, we can't certify you, so you found a place you could student teach and get certified.
Yes.
What did they say when you told them that?
He didn't say anything. They said, oh, well, very well. Have Mr. Peters get in touch with me for the paperwork. He didn't even say, you know, that's really good that you did that. Nothing. I think he was embarrassed. I don't think they tried too hard. I think they assumed that, of course, I couldn't go into a classroom.
I'm sure he was embarrassed because he didn't realize that hundreds of blind people are already doing it. You know, that this isn't a new thing. You weren't breaking.
Back in 1972, I don't know how many were, but he had no idea.
Had no idea.
God rest his soul, Brother Alfieri. He had no idea.
All right. So, but you wanted to do broadcasting, but you decided you would go ahead and teach. And teach what?
I got my degree. I student taught in a great class. It was kids who were. I never saw another class like this either. It was kids who were not quite ready for second grade, but they were done with first. It was kind of a catch-up where the kids could be in the room and do first grade and second grade work and improve their skills to go on to third, kind of. And it was a very neat neat school. I liked it. Then I went, at the insistence of the Commission for the Blind, I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, to that agency there. What do they call it now? Lion's World. And I was supposed to do the civil service program. They were doing the first civil service training program in 1973. And I ended up instead teaching Braille for a year there. It was a horrible place, but anyway.
Well, they've got it, and so they have to use it.
Right.
You know, it's the state owns it, and it's a place where you send people, and they pay the commission to send them there, so they got to use it.
Exactly.
So they sent
me
there.
And it's a quick closure. If you go there, they place you in a job. You know, even if you have to move to Gainesville and you don't want to, you know, it's a quick closure, and that's what people love because their funding depends on it and their jobs depend on it. So you're exactly right about that. I got my degree in special ed and TBI, and I taught adults for a little while in Connecticut. Then I switched to children, which I love. I want to give kids the same great start I got. So I really yeah. enjoy that. I have a great employer right now. I'm the only blind person who works at the agency. And when I got the job, they just said, you know, my boss just said, oh, well, of course we'll pay for your transportation. It wasn't even a question. It was a statement that he brought up. I didn't even
Wonderful.
Need to bring up the issue.
What a great place to work. They got any openings, I'll come up.
It's a wonderful place to work. I am extremely, extremely fortunate.
But, you know, I think it's also fair to say that before you worked at that in that kind of an environment, you also went through some that were the exact opposite in terms of what they were willing to help you with.
Hmm.
And ironically, yep. some of them were agencies for the blind.
Yep. I worked for 14 years teaching blind kids in Connecticut at the equivalent of the commission. And for a while, it was great because I had a real supportive supervisor. When she retired, things started to go downhill. Then they got a corrupt director. And after that, things really went downhill, and they were doing things like hiring me an assistant who couldn't read.
Hiring what? I missed that. Hiring
an assistant for me to drive me around and read my the eye doctor's reports and stuff like that who couldn't read. So that was exciting.
Really? I wouldn't want to ride with anybody who couldn't read. How would they, you know, they wouldn't know the signs. They couldn't.
Well,
they could read road signs, but
okay.
they couldn't read the kind of complicated
things that she needed.
Marcia was trying to read. I mean, they didn't know the difference between, I don't know, there was one example that you had mentioned once.
Oh, I was in a meeting once, and there's something, there's a visual impairment called rotary nystagmus. And my reader had very carefully given me the diagnosis as belated rotary nystagmus. And I said to myself, well, that's an odd way to put it, but I guess they mean that it wasn't discovered until the kid was two or three. Okay, I write it down. I go to a meeting, and I say that. And there's this long silence, and then somebody said, I believe you mean bilateral, which means, you know, both eyes. Well, I wanted to crawl under the desk.
Terrible, really.
You know, and I went and reported that, but I said, well, we'll just have to be more careful. We'll send him for training. And all.
And so this was... Here's a guy who's supposed to be reading, and he doesn't know the difference between belated and bilateral.
And this was this was the director's nephew or something. Some
might as well have been.
Yeah, might as well have been. It wasn't. It was.
It was. It ended up being along the sort of reverse discrimination kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, where this guy was in because he was a certain race and not for any other reason, not because he was qualified. And you hate to say that because there's certainly enough of the other kind of things where people are rejected for being a certain race.
Yeah.
But
and now this person is in the agency, and he does help with the books because he can match the publisher, you know, and get the right, you know, and do all that and get the books sent out to kids. So that's a good thing. He has a job. I taught him how to do that, actually. He's able to work there, and I'm happy for him. Because
we all need jobs, don't we?
He had little kids and everything. He wasn't a bad person.
But he was completely the wrong person for the job.
For that job.
Slotted him into, yeah. And they weren't about to change it.
All right. What did you, how was your, you went to this blind school as a day student, Steve, and graduated from the blind school?
No, not quite.
Not quite.
I'd say probably about fourth or fifth grade, my parents started making noises that they wanted to get me out of the school for the blind. And I didn't disagree with them because I really didn't want to be there anyway.
Yeah.
But I did have enough something or other. I don't know if it was sense. I think it was sense, but maybe other people would argue that it wasn't. But I thought that I should stay at the school for the blind until I picked up certain skills, one of which was the ability to type. Because if I didn't have that, I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to do the homework as I should in public school. So I said to my parents, look, I agree with you. I think I should get out of here, but I want to stay until I complete my typing course. And that wasn't going to happen until eighth grade. So I did stay up through the end of my eighth grade year, and then I went to Bloomfield High, which is the public school in the town that I lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful experience and absolutely the most frightening thing I'd ever done.
Imagine so.
All in the same breath. Because, it's an economy. It's we're talking about numbers here, really. I mean, in the school for the blind, I was in a class of 11 people. there were four of us that were really smart and the rest that were somewhere down at the other end of the scale. And I was in the smart group. In public school, there were 30 people just in any one of my classes, and not even and probably about 200 people in my in the class of 65, which I was a member of. So all of a sudden, you know, I was no longer the big fish in the small pond. I was a little tiny minnow in what I perceived to be somewhat a school of sharks. And part of it, and I went, I had felt this awesome responsibility of kind of like, you're no longer, you know, you're with the big kids now. You really have to do this right. You can't make mistakes. You're going to have to work twice as hard as anybody else in the world. And I did, but I think I also isolated myself from a lot of things because I was so afraid I would fail that I just never let myself go.
And you were just 14 years old.
Yeah.
You were...
Yeah, between 14 and 15. And I mean, I as it, you know, luckily, as hard as I worked, I also made friends and enjoyed myself. And so high school was a really good experience. And to this day, whenever they have reunions, I'm there because it was that kind of an experience for me.
So it finally leveled off and you did make some friends and it was a good experience,
yes,
high school.
It was. It was.
Yeah, because so many who do that never are able to adjust. But like you said, that's also depends a lot on the family and the person.
Well, I had a very supportive family, and I mean, number one, they wanted me to be there. But number two, they also wanted me to, they insisted that I be as normal as I could. You know, if I ever said to my parents, well, you know, an example, I said to my mom, I want to be able to, I'm old enough to be able to run the snowblower. I want to go out and do the driveway. She says, okay, fine, just don't get your fingers in the blades.
Well, good. That's the kind of parent you need.
That's right. And a lot of people thought she was cruel because she wouldn't stop me from doing things that I wanted to do. But she said, hey, why should I? She says, you know, I'm not going to be around. And my father said the same thing. He says, I'm not always going to be around, so you better learn to do as much as you can.
You could figure out where the damn snow was as good as anybody. I don't see why not.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't know that I did it perfectly, and I probably missed a few spots. But on the other hand, I didn't do it badly, and I didn't get into any stupid accidents. I mean, the worst thing I ever did was get one heck of a shock from the spark plug wire when I went to shut off the cutoff switch with my hand instead of using the side of my foot. And I did that once and never did it again.
You learn. We learn by doing.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
Now, were you also interested in broadcasting as a child?
Yes, I was. In fact, when I went to University of Connecticut, which is where I went to school, which is the complete opposite of Marcia's, population of UConn at the time was about 15,000. And I really liked the idea of a big campus because I wanted to get lost in that campus. I mean, I just wanted to be a part of a big, huge campus. And
really?
Really, University of Connecticut was kind of like a little city all of its own. And, of course, what was wonderful about it was that everything I wanted was within walking distance, which was not true of my home environment, which everything was within riding distance. And in Connecticut, unlike Massachusetts or unlike Boston area, we had crummy transportation down there, so if you didn't drive, you didn't go anywhere. So University of Connecticut was a great place for me because I could just hop on my feet and go where I needed to go.
And you took, you studied communications?
No, yeah. Actually, I majored in physics, or started out majoring in physics.
Really?
I wanted to major in engineering, but I had learned that there was an awful lot of drawing and drafting and visual stuff in engineering, so I decided that probably wasn't going to be real practical. So I decided instead to major in physics, naively assuming that, hey, you know, if I couldn't do the engineering, I could do the science. Now, what I didn't realize was that physics was all pretty high-level theory and pretty complicated math, and I just wasn't ready for it. So after a year of falling flat on my face in physics courses and not doing a whole lot better in math courses, I changed my major to sociology, deciding that if I couldn't... Oh, and why didn't I go into communication?
Why didn't you?
There was no courses related to broadcasting at UConn. The closest I could get was speech courses, and I knew that wasn't going to do it. It wasn't going to get me anywhere close, and so I figured, well, I got to major in something. So I spent a lot of time being at the radio station, which was my informal course in broadcasting.
Did they have a little on-campus radio station?
Yes, they did. 10-watt FM station and closed-circuit AM.
I can't imagine that they didn't have a communications course then.
Nope. They at that time, people weren't looking at broadcasting the way they do now, at least not at UConn. Maybe somewhere else they would have. If I had gone to Emerson, maybe they would have. But a lot of the reason that I chose UConn was because it was the one place I could get a full scholarship. And at that point, my father had died, and we didn't have any money. So it was
That's important,
much
scholarship.
If the commission didn't pay for it, nobody paid for it.
So if you hung around the radio station, they let you learn to do some things.
Oh, yeah. They were perfectly happy to let me do anything I wanted there. And I didn't actually try to do any of the engineering stuff because there was really only one person in the station who did, and that was our chief engineer, and he pretty much worked alone. But anything in the studios, anything I wanted to do there, they were perfectly willing to let me do. So I had a jazz show, and I had a rock show, top 40 kind of thing. And I also did some news blocks. And you'll appreciate this, Phil, as having worked in a station. I used to tie that patch panel up in knots that nobody could figure out what I was doing. But, you know, I could sit there and do the news blocks using two tape recorders and a cart machine. One of the tape recorders being in another studio, and I was the only person who wanted to do it that way. But to me, it was just a challenge, you know.
Well, you had to patch things together so you could hear in one ear and repeat. And
well, it wasn't even that they were live. It was just that I had all this stuff hooked up so that when the... Because, of course, being a non-commercial station, we had to run public services during the commercials.
Yeah.
And I made up my mind that I wasn't going to just do it the simple way, which would have been to, you know, play a 60-second commercial while the tape rolled. Because we were doing Paul Harvey, and, of course, with Paul Harvey, you never knew. You could have a 60-second or a 90-second or a 30-second,
yeah,
and you just never knew where you were. But for me, it was kind of a personal challenge to put 30-second public service carts in there and fast-forward the tape so that by the time the 30-second cart ended, I was queued up and ready to go with the rest of the newscast.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was kind of how I got my personal jollies, you know, doing the challenging part of engineering and operating the equipment better than anybody else and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes. And you, if you get ahead in radio, you have to be better than everybody else.
Yes.
Because they don't have, and we were still playing records back then, and we still had carts and all that stuff.
Right.
Which is...
But I never ended up in radio, and I think part of what really scared me, I had a counselor, and I don't know whether he did me a favor or not. At the time, I certainly didn't think he did, but he scared the bejeebers out of me in the sense of just telling me there is no way you're ever going to do this. You'll never make any money. If you do even get into this field, you're just going to be at some little station somewhere earning peanuts. They're never going to look at you for the big jobs. And I caved because, you know, unfortunately, a part of, I think, what plagues every blind person is the doubt that if somebody in authority says you're not going to be able to do this, there's a very good chance that you may not.
Well, you want to be able to make a living as a blind person.
That's
you want
right.
to be able to support yourself. And this person was basically right. There is no money in it, and they're not going to. You're going to end up. The only way I made it in radio was played music at night. My music supported my radio habit.
Right. Yeah. And so I ended up, after college, I worked in the field of drug counseling for a while, which kind of went along with my sociology major.
Yeah.
And after about 3 years, and I did it, I guess everything I've ever done, I've managed to do it in a slightly different way than most other blind people have done it. I mean, usually when a blind person says they've been a counselor, it means they've worked at an agency for the blind or at some rehab center or something like that. Well, yeah. I worked with drug addicts in groups, and it was some of the... It was some of the toughest work I ever did, some of the scariest work I ever did, and yet some of the most challenging.
They usually use people who have been addicts to do those kinds of things.
Yes, they did, and that was one of the challenges for me, that I had never been one. But what they said was, well, you may not have been an addict, but you certainly do know how, you certainly do know about the way people feel.
Yeah.
And you can use what you know of that, and you've certainly worked your way through adversity, so in some ways you can be an example of that. But after 3 years of doing it, I discovered that the only one who was getting better was me. And I was doing a marvelous job of counseling myself at extremely low pay and very high stress.
All right, so you went to, did what?
I did a total switch and went off to computer school because I decided that I would try my hand at that, and when I came in and took the test, I passed the test with very high marks, even though I had not been able to take a third of it because it was completely graphical and drawing, and I just couldn't do it. So
this was back. This was when?
This was in 1973.
So we were just getting into computers. That was kind of an unusual field for a blind person to
yes,
want
it was.
To fool with.
And I went in on the cutting edge of that, and I remember sitting down with a former roommate of mine, and he says, you know, he says, I wish you all the luck in the world, but I honestly don't think you're going to be able to do it. And I wish I could tell you differently. I mean, he was not the most positive guy in the world anyway, but...
But you did it anyway.
For 30 years.
And really?
Again, I still kind of broke all the rules in one sense, and I guess what I learned from different jobs that I've had is that if you can't do the job you want to do, and really what I wanted to do was be a system guy, in other words, the guy who did all the high-tech stuff.
Yeah.
But my training wasn't for that. I mean, the school I went to was cranking out programmers that worked for the insurance companies, and I didn't know that until I got into it. But the other problem is that as a blind person, you just didn't have the access to the manuals. You know, I couldn't, as a system programmer, I couldn't say, well, give me 6 months and I'll send this manual out to somebody and get it transcribed, and then I can sit down and read it. You had to be able to pull the manuals off the shelf and read them, and there just wasn't any way to do that. So,
well, of course, now you could, because we have the internet. You could download them and read.
Well, that's right. And now, and that did eventually start to happen, but not when I first got in. But what I ultimately learned to do was to accumulate a heck of a lot of knowledge in a lot of different areas, and I ended up doing a lot of customer support and doing it in ways that most people do not, which is to say, most customer support, you have a form and you sit there and you check, you go through a checklist of things and you ask all of these kind of questions and you get yes and no answers, and on the basis of the answers you get, you maybe give somebody advice and that's that. I did my customer support a completely different way. The checklist was in my head, and I had the background so that even if they didn't know what I knew and what I didn't, I could say, well, this seems a lot like another situation that I was involved with somewhere else, and here's what you're going to have to do. One of my greatest triumphs in the customer support business was I taught somebody how to use a printer that I had no manual for, and they didn't know how to use, but I taught them in 20 minutes. I got them up and running on the thing, and I said to them, we can do this as long as when I tell you to do something, you report exactly what you see.
Yeah, tell me what's on the screen, and we can get through this.
That's right. Not only tell me what's on the screen, but if I ask you to look something up in the manual, and you can look it up and read it to me and follow instructions, we'll do this, and we did. And so my customer support was very much based on relying on the reservoir of knowledge I had.
Yeah.
Not necessarily specific knowledge, but just, you know, general background and that kind of thing. And so as a result, I would take on problems that nobody else would take on, because their response would normally be, well, you know, we don't support the XK6SJ7GT. And I said, I don't care whether we support it or not. It's a printer.
And I can probably fix it.
And I can probably make it work, or I can probably tell you what's wrong with it so you can make it work.
We're getting kind of down close to the end. Marcia,
yes.
The other day you weren't around. We were going to do this interview on Friday, and Steve said you were, are you taking voice lessons?
I just started. That's one of my things. I took voice when I was a senior in high school, and I really liked it. But then I got to college, and I was very disappointed. My college had a crummy radio station. I did work there, but it was crummy, and a crummy chorus. And my chorus in high school was first rate. We got all kinds of state awards and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Our director was phenomenal. So I went from a high school wonderful chorus to college, where it's supposed to be better, and it was lousy. So I dropped it all, and I was pretty stupid because blind people are supposed to be gifted in music and geniuses in music and all that.
Yeah.
And all my relatives wanted me to, you know, just be this wonderful little angel who could sing. So I dropped the whole thing. I just wasn't interested. And when I went to Connecticut, I checked out a couple of choruses, but I didn't like them. So back here, I've found I'm in a church choir, and I like the director, and he offers voice lessons. So I just started, and I really like him. He's a good guy, and I think it'll help my voice. You know, he says I've retained some technique, which is a good thing, and it might help me in voiceover work or something as well.
Do either one of you play any instruments, either one of you?
I did play the piano. I studied piano for 10 years, but kind of as an act of rebellion, I guess. I wanted to do other things, and so my music kind of fell by the wayside when I was in college. And,
yeah.
I just got involved in other stuff.
And Marcia, you were going to look for voiceover work.
Yep. I'm going to see if I can do that. If I can't do radio, maybe do something like it. I play the piano a little bit and the guitar a little bit, so I'd like to get back into more of that. I have my piano from my mom's house that I had when I was a kid, so let's see what I can do with it. I think
yeah.
Now that I'm in my 50s, it's kind of like some time to do some stuff with my life that I want.
Now, you're going to retire, and Steve, you're already retired, is that right? So both
right.
of you are going to be retired, so you can do what you damn well please.
Right.
I'm not going to retire for a couple more years. Well, I'm going to see. I'm going to see where this radio thing goes. I guess what I was annoyed at my father for was, you know, okay, maybe you're right, Dad, but let me try it. Let me find out. You know, my brother, well, actually, he did try to dictate what my brother did, too, and my brother's fully sighted. But, I think we all need to check out what we want to do in life.
I did all right with radio. I moved to Lufkin in 72 to be, as Steve said a while ago, to be a big fish in a little pond, and I was number one morning man here for 10 or 12 years and
cool.
did remotes and, everywhere I went, there's Phil Parr. Oh, look at him. He's a big radio star. Of course, I was making 125 a week, 130. I think they raised me to 150 at one time. As an engineer, I was making, chief engineer, program director and operations manager. So anything that was wrong at the radio station was my fault.
Yep.
Wow.
And
I would love to try it. I'm going to see what I can do. I don't have any illusions about being some big radio star. I actually did work at a country station for 6 months on weekends in Connecticut. It was really fun. But it's like a drug. You just I took one course at Emerson College in Boston, which I loved. And, I would work endlessly for that course. It really is. If you've got that bug, if you've got that...
You can't leave it alone. All right, folks, we've killed an hour, a complete hour. Steve and Marcia address it. Doesn't really seem like it, does it?
No.
Just whisk by. Well, you both seem like you don't really need anybody's help, and go see what they've done in your kitchen today and see how little they've done, and you'll go, geez, it's been a whole day. You should have...
Actually, they did quite a bit.
Really?
They pulled out all the cabinets. They pulled out...
all the yucky paneling.
They tore down the paneling.
Yeah. So we won't be cooking supper tonight.
No, we won't.
No, we won't.
It's going to be...
Right.
Step out to the nearest restaurant.
We're completely...
Well, Phil, I hope we get to meet you sometime when you come to New England. I'd like that.
I will maybe... Maybe I will see you. We will talk about that. Maybe I will see you while I'm in Boston.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I will try to do that.
We aren't particularly interested in looking at leaves either, so maybe those of us who don't want to look at leaves can...
Right, hang on. Let me stop everything. We're up against time. Just hang on just a second, okay? Well, in further talking with Marcia and Steve Dresser, I found out that they do a radio show for, I think, for the local blind, some maybe local blind organization, organization of the blind, blind organization. The organization couldn't be blind, Phil, could it? It would be made up of blind persons. All right. Anyway, an organization of blind people in Boston, or in Massachusetts. I think they do a little monthly radio show. She is the host, and Steve is the engineer. And so we're going to do, when we get back maybe in November sometime, we'll do another show with those people and play some examples from their little radio show. I think Tim is involved in that also, so we'll look forward to that. As I say every week, we always need guests for these shows, and we tried to not make them a situation where you be under pressure or you feel like you're being interviewed or being on the spot to perform or to do a certain thing. We just like to talk to blind people about their lives, and I find it interesting to find out how other blind people handle situations and what they've done and where they've been, and I think it broadens us. We can now, with the Internet, and with things like this show and other shows, all kind of be on the same page. We can all realize that maybe something you thought was impossible, someone else is doing, and maybe they could help you or show me how to do it or how to pursue that. They are a totally blind couple, and they're obviously doing well. I wanted to get into how much sighted help they need. Of course, you would need some. All blind people need some sighted help. But anyway, what a nice couple, Steve and Marcia Dresser. And look forward to visiting with them while we're in Boston and doing another show with them a little later on. Got a couple of good interviews lined up that we're going to do in the next few weeks. Hope you'll join us for those. Guests, as I said, we always need. My address is Phil Parr, all one word, P-H-I-L-P-A-R-R, at Consolidated, C-O-N-S-O-L-I-D-A-T-E-D, consolidated.net. Phil Parr at consolidated.net. My phone number is 936-634-9500. Come and be a guest on either show, Blind Like Me or The Blind Handyman. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.